Atheist Nomads, episode 245, Rapping About Science with Baba Brinkman.
The podcast you're about to listen to includes cursing and talking about hoo-haws. Please be advised.
Welcome to another episode of Atheist Nomads. I am Dustin, and in a little bit, we'll have the interview with Baba Brinkman, where we'll be talking about rapping about science. This is going to be a lot of fun, so definitely look forward to the interview. And I'm not going to delay on getting to that for very long. Now, I do just want to remind you that we have a skill for the Amazon Echo devices, and I'm not going to use the watchword. So if you want to enable it, you just need to tell your Echo to enable the Atheist Nomad skill, and then you can listen to the show, and it's a really awesome skill. So well worth your time checking it out. And, also, it's not a bad time to remind you that we do have an app, and that's both in the Apple App Store and in the Google Play Store. It's another great way to keep up on the show, contact us, listen, and all of that. So check it out. But now, the interview. And we are now joined by Baba Brinkman. He is a Canadian scholar and hip-hop artist who has an amazingly impressive record, including the distinction of being the first ever peer-reviewed hip-hop artist. Baba, welcome to Atheist Nomads.
Well, it's my pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me on.
So how did you... Well, let's start with you with your background. Did you grow up religious at all?
I'd say I grew up spiritual. So my parents were... You know, they used to take me to ashrams and yoga retreats, and we'd... meet meditators and people that believe in things like reincarnation or astral travel or energy healing. So it's very, very sort of alternative world.
Okay. So kind of hippie.
Yeah. Hippie. Exactly. Yeah. I'm from Vancouver. So, pretty standard version of spirituality for Vancouver is what I grew up around. I mean, like my parents' friends and a lot of my friends growing up was basically like what everyone believed, and it wasn't controversial. We never were really into organized religion. You know, the idea floating around was kind of like, you know, there's a true God, spirit, intelligence source of some kind, and organized religion twisted it to their Machiavellian ends. But you can connect with that spirit directly through things like meditation. There's such thing as a soul, but not necessarily a personal God, more of like a kind of energy force or something like that.
Okay. Yeah. When you get on the West Coast, there's a lot of that.
Yeah. I mean, now that I've become much more of an empiricist and skeptical of a lot of the spiritual claims as well as the religious ones, I still am more sympathetic to that kind of religious thinking than to this book is the word of God kind of religious thinking, mm-hmm. even though I don't know that either of them are necessarily any more preposterous or less preposterous or more. I think they're both factually inaccurate, but I just find the spiritual stuff a little less offensive. And I think you could make a case that it's less damaging as well in terms of like promoting things like bigotry or misogyny or homophobia.
And I would kind of go with, at this point, I have a niece who's gone full on hippie, and, she and her child will not be seeing, my little baby until, flu season is over and she's got more of her vaccines, and won't be, seeing her until she's got her MMR if there's any, measles outbreaks.
Yeah, we had similar discussions in my family when I've got a 4-year-old and a 1-year-old now, but definitely there was some, is everyone up to date on shots when you get them around the infant? And then there's some pushback, like, you know, how important is that really? And is there a, you know, pharmaceutical commercial interest in your, you know, supposedly medically advised, admonitions to make sure we're all vaccinated? And we're like, actually, we don't really care about that. We're just going with the CDC recommendations.
Wow. How did your family respond to that?
There was some discussions of, you know, there was some like, don't impose your ideology on us kind of pushback at first. And eventually there was like, okay, we get it. You know, we'll respect your views. even though they aren't ours, and they're not, I wouldn't really call them anti-vaccine, but they're not like, you know, pro-vaccine either. Mm-hmm. They're kind of vaccine ambivalent, let's say.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. There's a terrifying amount of that going on.
Yeah, it's funny. Like, sending people links to science stories and stuff is, you know, that's kind of my go-to. Like, oh, you want to see some back? Here's some links to evidence, and then, you know, they got links too, and it's just, you have to find a friendly dialogue when it comes to family and friends. This, you know, it's not just a peer-reviewed science based on data kind of level of debate. I don't know if you've heard it, but I have a song called Creationist Cousins, where I talk about the challenge of debating spirituality and religion and, you know, the age of the earth with my young earth creationist cousins. And when you're talking to family, you can't sort of revert to the easy, you're crazy or you're stupid kind of
right.
impulse response to this stuff. You have to, okay, so why do you believe that? Oh, here's why I believe what I believe. And here's what I think the negative consequences are of following these kinds of beliefs versus those to their logical conclusion. And, you know, yeah, it's sort of a mix of the, you know, the evidence base for your beliefs and the sort of principled consequences of them and stuff like that. So
yeah,
I think there's more, you could say more about the principled consequences of vaccine denial than you can about creationism. It's hard to say, like, believing in creationism means you're going to hurt for in this kind of way. I mean, you can say you're going to like have a hard time in college
right?
or, yeah. you know, be bewildered at a natural history museum, or, you know, just that it fosters a sense of incuriosity and conspiratorial thinking towards science in general, which just shuts you out of tons of fascinating findings that you would otherwise be able to engage with. But, you know, nobody dies necessarily.
Yeah. And it's a being one of those weird ones of like, I would personally kind of go with young earth creationism and conservative Christian beliefs like that, because it's always tied with so much more very bigoted thinking that is far more dangerous to society. But the like anti-vax movement, that can be very dangerous to very vulnerable individuals.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, that's a left-wing anti-science position, mm-hmm. isn't it?
Yeah.
So it cuts across the spectrum.
Yeah. So how did you get out of the spiritual hippy dippy thinking?
It was the product of a job that I took on, which was also the beginning of this whole peer reviewed rap phenomenon. So in 2008, I had this rap version of Chaucer's Canterbury Tales that I was touring around the UK. That's what I did my degree in, was comparative literature. So I'm like performing my medieval literature raps around England, as you do. And I went to this event at the University of Birmingham in England, and there's a professor there named Dr. Mark Palin, and he helped to organize the event. It was the medieval literature raps, but the backstory is actually kind of cool too. It's Birmingham at the time was the only university in the world where the medieval literature scholars were publishing collaborative work with the microbiology scholars. And when I heard that, I was like, how is that even possible? Because I did a humanities degree and I don't remember much microbiology. But it turns out that there's manuscript variants from 15th century extant manuscripts of the Canterbury Tales. And they've all been collated into databases where you know each different spelling and each different word use in the 50 or so surviving copies of Chaucer's Canterbury Tales. And previously, arguments about primacy of which is the sort of archival original version were based on subjective assessments of dialects and word usages and, you know, historical analysis of different like language evolution trends in England. And this was the first time they had an empirical way to analyze the primacy of Chaucer manuscripts by feeding all those manuscript variants into phylogenetic DNA analysis software, which produces a family tree. If you put a bunch of bacteria into the software, you can tell, you know, the sort of historical relationship of which ones evolved from which ones and how long they've been separated based on molecular clocks. And it turns out you can do that with scribal copying errors as well. So they had a published paper in Nature saying, here's a phylogenetic evolutionary tree of Chaucerian manuscript descent, because if one scribe would make a mistake, every scribe that copied from his version would make the mm-hmm. same mistake, and that would sort of show up as a family tree. Anyway, I thought it was pretty cool art science yeah. collaboration initiative. So that yeah, group, the biology amazing. Yeah, so they were already all friends, you know, they've been collaborating, they've got these, you know, these variant databases that they're running through DNA software and analysis software. And then the Chaucer people were like, you know, there's this guy that raps Chaucer. We should get him to come and perform. And the biologists reached out to me and they were like, how about doing some raps about Darwin too? So it was kind of this challenge that was thrown in my lap. And I wrote one song for when I came there with my Chaucer show. And it was the song Natural Selection that became the first track on my album from the next year called The Rap Guide to Evolution. So Mark Palin was the sort of main biology person that initiated that. And he put me this challenge. This is, let's say, like September 2008. He's like, February next year is Charles Darwin's 200th birthday. I'm organizing a big Darwin symposium here at the university. All the big evolution scholars from around the UK are coming. And I want you to be the entertainment with your brand new rap Darwin show that you're going to write between now and then. Because he was like, you know, he was like, if you can do Chaucer, you can do Darwin. And I was like, oh, yeah, of course, sign me up. But I did not really... you know, have a specialist level of evolutionary knowledge. So I had this sort of 6-month window to read up and write a bunch of evolution raps. And Mark was like, you better send them to me in advance so I can make sure you got the science right. And so then he came up with this idea of, okay, now I'm doing peer reviewed rap. And also over the course of that 6-month period, I was like, you know, I grew up agreeing with evolution and disagreeing with creationism. I used to argue with my creationist cousins and, you know, get into it with street preachers and stuff like that. But I didn't really go to the depth of what the difference is. You know, I was like, obviously evolution's right. But when you get closer, you're like, okay, well, the only real sense in which you can say one is right and the other isn't is by the scientific method and, you know, empirical research and data. And so then, you know, the evolution defender books that I was reading and blogs and, you know, it kind of put me onto the phenomenon of scientific skepticism. And it didn't take me long for, you know, of researching where I was like, oh, if I need a leg to stand on to defend evolution and talk about what it means, unfortunately, like my homeopathy pills are going to have to go in the garbage now. Mm-hmm. So I was not skeptical of alternative medicine at all when I started the project. I kind of grew up using it and thought seems to work for me. And then I read a few books. I read Bad Science by Ben Goldacre and Trick or Treatment by Simon Singh. And I also did some gigs in England. I ended up like meeting a bunch of science communication comics, and Robin Ince had this whole like science comedy gig going on. And I met these skeptics and these alternative medicine debunkers. And I, you know, found out about this, you know, the amazing meetings, TAM phenomenon, and got to perform there in London. And, you know, I basically reviewed my beliefs in light of my new appreciation for evolutionary science and the scientific method. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, you know, maybe I don't need to keep all of these supernatural beliefs that I grew up with. I don't know that they're really doing much good for me. And I would feel like a hypocrite if I was going to defend, you know, one domain of scientific discovery and then go say that scientists are a bunch of conspiracy perpetrators in some other domains. You know, sort of turned over the course of that year into a general science advocate and defender. And that has ended up bleeding into all kinds of other domains. And, you know, I kind of broke with the people that I used to agree with in the alternative Canadian culture about lots of things, not just alternative medicine.
Yeah. Now, okay, backing up a little bit, how did you get started doing medieval literature rap?
I was an English nerd, so I did a comparative literature undergraduate degree, honors degree, and then I also did a master's. But by the time I did the master's, I was already very rap obsessed and rap dedicated. So I was a hip hop fan as a teenager, but I didn't really rap myself. And I started writing rhymes maybe in my like second year of college and sort of looking for a way I could, you know, participate in hip hop culture that would be authentic when I was so obviously not street. You know, mm-hmm. I'm like this bookish suburban Canadian. I don't come from where rap comes from. I don't like sound like rappers sound like, but I just love the art form so much. And, you know, I memorized lyrics since I was a kid and used to like recite different raps, but it was only when I got into my English lit degree and I'm reading my way through the Norton anthology and I'm like Chaucer, Skelton, William Blake, John Donne, you know, these guys were the rappers of their time, and the parallels between what the rappers were saying and what the poets were saying. You know, I was kind of like, rap is at a certain point I decided slash deduced that rap is filling the traditional literary entertainment niche that poetry once did, especially in Chaucer's time, right? In Chaucer's time, poetry was an oral recitation phenomenon. Books were rare and expensive, and literacy was rare. And most people only knew poetry from oral recitation, and people who got a reputation of being the most entertaining and witty poets were the ones that would gain status and respect amongst their peers and climb the upward mobility hierarchy of the social strata. And that's what I see the Canterbury Tales as being all about, is sort of using your skill with words to transcend your circumstances. That's exactly what rap is about, too. So that's, I ended up writing my thesis about that, and I was like translating the Canterbury Tales into my own raps on the side to sort of show the connection. And so, yeah, that's where it all came together.
Well, but and it makes perfect sense that if you live in a time when most people aren't literate, if you want your words to get as much attention as possible, you need to make it easy to convey to people who are not literate. And so making it easier to be told orally, that would definitely go a long ways towards expanding your audience.
Yeah, and you know, you also got to, like, in Chaucer's time, it's not like, oh, you know, where's all the literate people? I guess they're not around, so we have to revert to oral. They're continuous with the past 100,000 years of our species, during which oral recitation of poetry was pretty much the only kind. Writing is a very recent development. Yeah. And, you know, even if it has been in the you know, in the world in various forms for 5,000 to 7,000 years, like 99% of the time, 99% of people didn't have access to it. So I think there's something really visceral about listening to a stylized poetry performance where someone is just really like using language in a virtuoso way with, you know, syncopated rhythm and social commentary and metaphor and simile and representations, symbolism, all that, you know, that's what rappers are doing. And that's what poets have always done. That's what Homer is. That's what Beowulf is. That's what poetry was. And then part of my thesis was looking at like how literary poetry eventually took over and sort of usurped the oral poetry tradition, which I think was kind of a guns, germs, and steel style technology outcome of the invention of the printing press, where suddenly you can reach a much wider audience by printing and having a silent readership appreciate your poetry from afar. And then, like, what's the point of making it sound good at that point? It's just got to be thinky, you know, and that's where you get this sort of shift from rhymed narrative poetry to abstract modernist free verse poetry. And so, you know, when you say poetry today, you don't necessarily think like entertaining, earthy narrative, like live recitation, but that's what it almost always was until the past, you know, few hundred years anyway. So well, my thesis argued that basically rap is more similar to what poetry almost always was throughout the history of our species, and what Chaucer's poetry still represents, i.e. a sort of written representation of an oral event, and that rappers should be seen as the inheritors of not just African poetry traditions, but the world's poetry traditions, especially because also rap is, you know, rap came from America, which is a melting pot. You know, the, like all these rappers that were the pioneers in the 70s and 80s, they went to high school, you know, they had to read Shakespeare. They had, like, you know, English literary exposure and knowledge. And they explicitly sometimes would refer to themselves as, you know, Edgar Allan or the new Shakespeare, you know, it's the abstract poetic prominent like Shakespeare. That's Q-Tip in the 90s. So it's like, okay, so they already see themselves as inheriting the Shakespearean tradition. Let's look deeper into, you know, is that just a metaphor? Actually, no, they're actually doing that on a sociological level as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm thinking through various pieces of early modern literature, and it seems like somewhere around 1800, it lost the poetry.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the romantics were pretty poetic, I'd say.
Yeah.
And you know, some Enlightenment poets too, like Alexander Pope was pretty deadly with the rhyme. Mm-hmm. you know, the Wordsworth and Coleridge era of the Romantics started to explore like more, you know, less stylized, more natural language approaches. I think it's the free verse. It's the Walt Whitman phenomenon. That's where it really changed. That was, well, you know, there was pushback earlier, obviously, like Milton didn't rhyme, right? Paradise Lost doesn't rhyme. It's, you know, that's where blank verse comes in. Shakespeare is mostly blank verse. So there, you know, this sort of starts with a pushback against rhyme, saying rhyme is a sort of unnatural imposition on poetry. And then from there, you know, it takes a few hundred years to get to like all structure is an unnatural imposition on poetry. And pretty soon poetry just becomes like a, you know, indistinguishable from prose, but broken up into shorter lines in order to convey some kind of emphasis of, you know, more focus on the content of each line or whatever. But, you know, I had this feeling in university where I was like, why do I love all the old poetry and hate all the modern poetry and love rap? Is that just a coincidence? And at a certain point, I was like, no, actually, rappers are more like the old poetry than the new poetry is like the old poetry. So that's the kind of concept I wrote my thesis around. And after I graduated in 2003 with a master's in comparative literature, and you know, my professors were keen to encourage me to continue as a scholar. Oh, where are you going to apply to do a PhD? And I was like, nah, sorry, I'm going to be a rapper now. My like mentality was I'm going to show the world this connection. I'm not going to just try to publish about it in literary journals. So I did this sort of one man, 1 hour show that I took to a bunch of fringe festivals, and sort of 2004 until 2008, I was the Chaucer rap guy. And I toured colleges. I performed at Harvard and Wellesley and, Ohio State and, you know, Colgate and all these, I did like a 3 month tour all over US college campuses. And, you know, that I was kind of doing that and thinking about what I'm going to do next. You know, this Chaucer thing's been well received when I stumbled onto Mark Palin and the evolution thing. And then that just, you know, seemed like such a powerful combination, rap and evolution. I thought rap and Chaucer was fun, but rap and evolution was 10 times more fun, especially because like there's no controversy in rap and Chaucer, except maybe the thumbing your nose at the traditional establishment of medievalists who think that Chaucer should remain pure or something. But that's you know, a fairly tame form of rebellion compared to poking creationists in the eye with proclamations about how, yes, we did indeed evolve from fish and ancestral fish-like and monkey-like and amoeba-like forebears. There's something very transgressive about that.
Yeah. Yeah. Man, that's really cool.
Ironically, I was a fairly like, I'm not going to say like mild mannered. There was some swagger in my Chaucer rap, approach, but as a humanities person, I always had this kind of like, this is just my interpretation of things. You know, I did have a kind of postmodern, mentality towards it. And, you know, it's hard to have swagger when you're like, this is how it is, or could be through my constructed interpretive framework, but maybe it's different through your constructive interpretive framework. Therefore, it's all just a dialectic. What? Like, where's the swagger in that? But, you know, but then when I'm researching evolution, I'm like, every biologist in the world worth their salt is on board with some of these basic truths, i.e. our species evolved in Africa. We share common ancestors with bananas. You know, there was a single origin to the entire genealogy of every living thing in the world today. That doesn't mean their life only evolved once, but the version of life that's around today only evolved once and then diversified into everything alive. And, you know, the more of this stuff I came across, the more I could sort of go, well, you know, there are a few legitimate debates around things like, you know, the speed or adaptationism versus punctuated equilibrium, although I'd say adaptationism pretty much won that debate. And then there's group selection versus individual selection. So there's a few sort of like legitimate internal scholarly debates that are interesting to represent. But there's also a very wide range of things where you can say everyone that knows how biology works agrees on this stuff. And it actually gave me, ironically, a lot more rap swagger than I had before, because I could stand on stage and say, like, what? I represent science. You know, you want to take it up with me, take it up with the army of researchers marching behind me. And sort of, you know, I just felt like I could really sort of lay it down in a hip hop kind of way that I hadn't before. So, you know, that rap guide to X kind of concept that the first one represented, because Mark's book was called The Rough Guide to Evolution. So he said, why don't you call it The Rap Guide to Evolution, sort of as a joke tie-in. But then I was like, wow, there could be rap guides to lots of things if this one works out. So yeah, that takes us to 2009, and literally like the last 8 years, I've just been producing rap guides to everything I'm interested in and everything I can find an audience for. And I got an off-Broadway production right now that's The Rap Guide to Consciousness, which is all neuroscience and cognitive psychology stuff, evolution of brains. I did climate change a couple years ago, and I'm just sort of working my way through the good science material piece by piece.
And the climate change one, you went to the UN with that one, right?
The COP 22, the Paris Agreement. I was there performing my climate raps for various events in Paris when that was going down. So and that one also was an off-Broadway show, and Bill Nye made his rap debut kicking the chorus on one of those tracks, which is a remix of the notorious B.I.G. song Dead Wrong. And not Dead Wrong. Sorry. Dead Wrong is the natural selection track from Evolution. The one with Bill Nye is What's Beef. Although I always need to include the caveat that in that context, beef signifies impassioned scientific disputation, not violent conflict, which is what Biggie was referring to in terms of what beef means. Nice. I don't think there's any, there's not really physical scraps between climate deniers and climate scientists, as far as I know, but it does get pretty heated.
Yeah. Yeah. They're not going to be the ones fighting. It's going to be the people who want drinking water and land that's not flooded.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. The beef is a consequence of climate change.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily what's happening in the halls of science.
Yeah. Mm. So what are some of the other guides you've done? You did one on medicine, right?
Yeah. Rap Guide to Medicine was never a show. That was just an album, and it was commissioned by ASU. ASU has a Center for Evolutionary Medicine and Public Health, and the person that runs it is Randy Nessie, who wrote the book Why We Get Sick with George C. Williams. So that was Randy hearing some of the evolution raps and saying, do you think you could do evolutionary medicine? And I had already come across a bit of his stuff as part of my research for the first project, so I was right into that. But, you know, it's called Rap Guide to Medicine, but specifically evolutionary medicine, like not how to treat a disease, although that, you know, that's part of it, but also why does disease exist in the first place?
Okay.
What sort of evolutionary history led to the vulnerability to the disease, which is often some kind of trade-off between survival and reproduction, or it's some kind of conflict of interest between our attempts to perpetuate our genes and, let's say, an amoeba's attempt to perpetuate its genes.
Mm-hmm.
It's a kind of new chapter in the study of medicine in a way, because you right now teach the etiology of the disease and the diagnosis of the disease and the treatment, but it's not necessarily part of the picture to say, the evolutionary story of how it came to exist, but knowing the evolution of the disease can actually help a lot in terms of designing a research paradigm mm-hmm. that'll produce results. So if you're just sort of like, unfortunately God made us sick like this, then you don't really have as many avenues of possible approach for how to deal with it. Right. If you can look at how the evolutionary history of our immune system is interacting with the evolutionary history of, you know, this organism that has evolved to try to beat our immune system, mm-hmm. that can suggest like novel avenues to deal with it. So there we go. Yeah. Actually, we've come full circle, because in a way you could say creationism is really bad for health. Maybe it's even worse than vaccines in a way, because, creationism among members of the medical profession does create blind spots around possible ways that disease can be, treated and remedied in creative ways.
And, despite that, you end up getting people like Ben Carson, who was one of the greatest pediatric neurosurgeons of all time and a complete and utter buffoon in all other areas of life.
Yeah. Well, that's a very specialist set of skills operating on a brain, I guess. You can be uninformed as to what a brain is and where it comes from and still completely understand how it works.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it's probably by analogy, you can be a completely virtuoso car mechanic and think that cars were made by magic elves.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You don't need to know how a car is made to repair it if you learn all the details.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want to, you know, I don't know. I think surgery is a very specific domain of, you know, there's an exact best practices, right thing to do, which is different than public health.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think if Ben Carson were a world renowned public health specialist trying to deal with things like the flu virus or Zika outbreaks or things like that, understanding how the disease evolves and how various treatments are going to induce it to evolve in different ways. Even cancer, like evolution is core to lots of different public health and treatment questions now, but yeah. Surgery is like this oasis of not necessarily evolutionary thinking because it's a structural intervention.
Now, like, and the one example is there's Loma Linda University in Southern California. It is one of the leading cancer research facilities, and it's run by the Seventh-day Adventist Church, officially creationist. But they believe in microevolution, minor changes. So mutations happening, they don't have any problem with that, just so long as it doesn't change species.
Yeah, well, I think you're right. That's a good point. And I think your belief about the age of the earth is the only way you can give shelter to that kind of ignorance, really. Like, if you believe the earth is not as old as scientists say that it is, then you can believe that microevolution is fully functioning at the level of disease resistance and drug design, but it could never have enough time to add up to the kinds of changes that would be needed to, you know, turn a chimpanzee into a human or ape-like ancestor that probably resembled a chimpanzee more into a human. But if you give the world its 4.5 billion years and start life ticking at 3.5 billion years ago, it's just very hard to imagine how that mutation process could last that long and not add up to some big changes.
Oh, yeah. And even with like tracking the flu virus, as long as it's still the flu virus, then it doesn't break their paradigm.
Right.
But if an influenza strain becomes HIV, well, that would break their paradigm.
Yeah, but where does the vulnerability to disease in us come from a creationist perspective?
Sin,
right? That's the God is putting the trials of Job on us when we get cancer in the creationist view, but in the evolutionary view, our immune system has evolve to fight outside pathogens and, the mutations that happen inside the nuclei of certain cells can cause those cells to behave like some kind of novel organism that's trying to grow and consume as much resources as possible. And that's a tumor. And, the sort of dynamics that make disease exist in the first place for us, a good example that comes up in a lot of, intelligent design debunking is the recurrent laryngeal nerve. You got a nerve that goes from your brain to your larynx controlling your voice. It's what's allowing me to speak right now, but it goes down underneath the aorta of my heart and then comes back up to my throat. And there's all these sort of like design flaws in the body that suggest that either God was drunk when he designed us, or it was a very long and convoluted sort of trial and error process that was the blind watchmaker's work, not some intelligent designer.
And that nerve is such a pain in the ass. It can cause a lot of problems if you happen to be susceptible to vasovagal reactions or hypotensive reactions, because that's all happening from that same nerve. And I don't know the explanation on how that ends up tying in, but I suspect it has something to do with the heart rate changing and that screwing with that nerve, which would make sense since it's wrapping around the heart. It's just weird.
Well, I remember telling my dad one time about the nerve and how it loops under the heart. And he had some quip about, well, that's clearly how we're able to speak from the heart. I think he was being tongue in cheek, though.
Oh, man.
That was a creationist. jibe.
But with the where creationists think all that came from is if you really would try to pin down the belief, ultimately it comes down to God designed humanity flawed and gave them the treatment to that flaw with the tree of life. Because as soon as they lost access to the tree of life, they started dying.
But how does that explain like individual disease situations or, you know, a person that gets sick? I can see that in sort of like where that's where the susceptibility uh-huh. comes from, but why like you and not someone else or vice versa?
That one ends up being a lot harder to suss out. I think if I remember correctly, it ultimately, and I don't think anybody would actually really admit to it, but sins causing mutations.
I never heard that one before.
Yeah, it's because it's insane and nobody would admit to it, but it's the explanation that explains it the best. Instead, they try to use poetic ways to skirt around it. Hmm. Atheist Nomads is proudly brought to you by listeners just like you. You can find out how you can become a patron at patreon.com/atheistnomads. That's patreon.com/atheistnomads. So how have you, especially since you've gone the science route, how do you relate in the hip hop community?
Rappers that know about me tend to like be appreciative of it, but I don't know that I'm not really on the radar of many famous rappers, let's say.
Okay.
I'm friends with rappers that are at similar levels to me, i.e. rappers that have sort of thousands to tens of thousands of fans, but I'm not friends with rappers that have hundreds of thousands to millions of fans.
Okay.
Because they tend to, you know, associate in groups along mm-hmm. those lines. That's the response I've gotten off of the hip hop community that's encountered me has been very positive. But I'd say that's a pretty small percentage of it. And, I think generally the response I get is like, good for you for doing something different, not just trying to like, you know, tell the same story as everyone else or say the same rhymes. There's always an initial, you know, I had a good conversation. I did my show last weekend. I opened my off-Broadway show and there's a guy there that works security and he's been affiliated with the hip hop community in New York for a long time. His name is ICU and he's actually in KRS-One's My Philosophy classic BDP track when KRS says, my brother Kenny Parker, my other brother ICU is much darker, and that's ICU who now works at the venue that I'm performing at. So you know he came and saw the show, and he you know admitted to me afterwards, he was like, okay, you know, I was a little skeptical. I see this like poster with a white boy saying he's going to rap about science. Don't necessarily have the highest hopes, but he was like, it's dope, man. You can tell people, I think your show's dope. And it is really like it's a love letter. It's a love letter to hip hop. Like I grew up on hip hop. I like listened to it since I was 10 years old, totally part of my education and identity. And, you know, just went to shows and participated as much as I could in the culture in every way as a fan and as an artist since way back. And people don't necessarily expect me to be good when they see me. And, you know, I don't begrudge them that. I've actually got a song in my show called Good Bayesian, and the whole thing is about how our ways of thinking are actually in a way just like statistical predictions of heuristics and probabilities in our environment. And part of the product of that is that people have low statistical estimations of my likelihood of being a good rapper when they see me. And, you know, I'm at peace with that. But if you want to be a good Bayesian and a scientific thinker, then when you take in information, you revise your predictions. Mm-hmm. So if you hear me rap once and I blow your mind, then maybe next time your expectations will be higher.
Oh, that's awesome.
Let me show you how to be a good Bayesian. Change your predictions after taking information in. And if you're thinking I'll be less than amazing, let's adjust those expectations. But, you know, that's me having fun with a very common phenomenon, which is people looking at me and being like, you're a rapper, really? And then when I get to, you know, actually bust a rhyme, then I tend to get a pretty positive response. But, yeah, you know, that's how it's going to be.
Hey, what's the difference between rap and hip hop?
You ask different people, they'll give you a different answer to that. But I think KRS-One's been a pretty good guide for me in my understanding. Basically, that rap is the oral expression of hip hop, which is a much wider culture. So rap is the music and poetry expression of hip hop culture. Breakdancing is the dance expression of hip hop culture. Graffiti is the artistic expression of it. It's just that,
okay,
you know, through commercial processes and maybe a historical accident of like what caught on when you say rap, you get more recognition than when you say hip hop. Like, mm-hmm. even though rap is like a subset, like rap is like one branch on a tree of hip hop. That's all these other cultural expressions. More people have heard of rap than have heard of hip hop. But
all right, yeah,
that's how they seem to go together to me.
All right. So kind of like the difference between country western and rednecks.
I think you probably get a lot of country fans that would take umbrage at that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know there would be quite a few.
Maybe it's more like you could think of medicine as a subset of biology, right? Like there's no medicine without biology in terms of understanding and study of it, but people will probably reactively think of medicine as more relevant and mainstream, more, you know, it's probably more people interested in studying medicine than studying biology. You like think of them as separate, and you think of medicine as being more important maybe, but you mm-hmm. don't necessarily think of medicine as being a subset of biology. That's like rap and hip hop.
Okay. Yeah. Application versus, makes sense. Tell me about the off-Broadway plays you're doing.
Yeah. So, I mean, the typical hip hop venue, like a nightclub where you're doing tracks and people are dancing and getting down. I never really found those were too conducive to what I was doing. I do like just freestyle and rap for a crowd kind of stuff as well, but that never really became my main gig. I always had like concept raps in this academic niche. So I just kind of evolved into doing it in theaters because that's where I could get people to pay attention and let me tell a story for an hour and sort of work my way through threads. And, you know, when I did the Canterbury Tales, it was like, I did do it in a couple of like poetry and music venues. And I felt like I needed more from a crowd, you know, I needed like, okay, let me take you on a journey kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, you know, that fringe theaters was where I found the core audience for what I was doing. And then off-Broadway theaters are kind of like fringe theaters, only, New York Brass Ring. You can get a review in the New York Times that blows you up, or, you know, people come through that you wouldn't expect that you've heard of. And, you know, it's just, I think a lot of fringe is sort of all around the world, but off-Broadway is like a natural ascension of where a fringe show can go. You know, it's like mm-hmm. when I had the chance to start doing off-Broadway shows, I was like, okay, fringes are fun, but like it's nothing like doing a residency month after month where you can really like build a buzz in a city like this.
Okay. So is you performing?
Yeah. It's listed as a play. I actually bill it as comedy as well, 'cause I write, there's a lot of jokes in the show. And a lot of the lyrics are sort of punchline lyrics, but it's a one man show. It's me on a stage, like a 200 seat off Broadway theater. Sound system's pretty fat. We got some good subs in there. So, you know, sometimes it feels like a rap concert and there's call and response and throw your hands in the air and all that. But, you know, actually when I describe it, I sometimes say it's like one third rap concert, one third stand up comedy, and one third TED talk. Because I'll do sort of like science lecture bits and then do a track and then do some comedy to set it up. And I work with a visual designer. Her name is Olivia Sebesky, and she kind of like takes my script and works out some kind of animated projected image or graphic complement that helps to tell the story. In this case, I've done five of these so far, rap guides to various things as off-Broadway productions here in New York, but the new one's Consciousness. So, you know, I'm sort of taking people step by step through the neuroscience of human experience and how it's possible for you to, you know, see things and talk about them and reflect on them and have a sense of self and a sort of personal subjective perspective that's looking out at the world and taking in sensations and stuff like that? What is the, how does that sort of come together in terms of brain cells, which is a complicated story to tell and make personal, but in a way it's the most personal thing in the world, because it's what you experience right now. And it's what all of your listeners are experiencing right now while they listen, whether they're listening and actually focusing on this 100% or whether they're doing the dishes or driving or whatever, their consciousness has contents. And those contents, sights, sounds, feelings, memories, emotions, ideas, all that stuff is, you know, that's signals of neurons firing at each other and exchanging biochemicals. And there's a whole new research field, which is specifically about the sort of neuroscience of phenomenological experience. And that's what my new show is about. So I take people through it, like a journey into the brain. And also there's a lot of, you know, meditation and psychedelics references and the sort of like fringes of what human experience can touch on.
That sounds really cool.
It's pretty fun. It's pretty, it's, you know, the sort of higher level side of it is it's cool to just like turn people onto science and, you know, also turn people onto hip hop in a way, because a theater audience isn't necessarily a rap audience. So a lot of people are coming to my show just because they like going to see Off-Broadway theater in New York. And afterwards, they'll be like, oh, if that's what rap is, it's actually kind of a generational thing. If I talk to my audience afterwards, if they're sort of over 50, they'll often be like, well, I never liked rap, but maybe I'll give it another chance. And if they're under 50, they'll be like, wow, that science is pretty cool. I might have to go check those books out.
That's awesome.
But yeah, I think both of those are pretty core to my agenda. You know, I've been a big sort of hip hop booster since I was like 10 years old, and the chance to be an ambassador for hip hop to people that wouldn't necessarily listen to it or you know, think it was very sophisticated or impressive. You know, that's a form of consciousness raising, I'd say. And then also, obviously, my agenda is like spreading science literacy and critical thinking and just enthusiasm, you know, just an appreciation of how the story of who we are as a species, where we came from, where we're going, you know, what we're capable of, all that is being sketched out by scientific research right now. And it's inspiring. All the discoveries are inspiring, and you know what they mean and how we can respond to them and not, you know, get either bewildered or, you know, existential malaise from being reminded that we're just biological robots with code instantiated on neural signals. That's you know, sometimes people have a little cringe reaction when they hear that, but
yeah,
I guess someone's got to stand up there and say, sorry, you don't have a soul. Well,
yeah.
Not necessarily, you know, not a supernatural one anyway. The lyric is, if you have a soul, it's distributed in code across your parietal, frontal, and temporal lobe. And when they disintegrate, it's got nowhere to go unless we can learn to upload it to silicone as a computer code, which would be super dope and might happen in your life, except it probably won't. So there's no encore. This is the show, and you're just on for a minute or so. So there's a sort of, you know, carpe diem message in there as well. If there's no afterlife, which there's no scientific reason to believe there is, then doesn't that make every moment more precious?
Yeah, yeah. So do you still mostly live in Vancouver?
Oh, no. I've been in New York now for about 7 years.
Oh, okay. So you're in New York full time.
Yeah. I moved here in 2011 to do my first Off-Broadway production. That was Rap Guide to Evolution. And then now I'm doing Consciousness, and this is the fifth. So it's sort of a series. The venue's called the Soho Playhouse. That's where I've been doing my various residencies, and the artistic director there, Darren Lee Cole, also directs the shows. So I just, you know, I lucked out. I found someone here in New York that really gets what I do and wants to collaborate and help to spread it to, you know, to a larger audience. So we've just, you know, we've done show after show together. It's been a really great process. And I also, put down roots here about a year and a half after I moved here. I met, now my wife, Dr. Heather Berlin, who is a neuroscientist. So a lot of this, neuroscience of consciousness stuff comes from her. She's sort of an expert in the field, introduced me to the researchers, put me onto what I need to read to get up on it.
Okay. Yeah.
We have two kids, and we live, you know, about 45 minutes outside the city, in Long Island.
Oh, sweet. So how do you integrate all of this with your family? Do you find it influences, your parenting?
I don't know. I the only way to answer that would be if I had an identical twin with different beliefs, who's parenting their kids, slightly differently. But how does it influence my parenting? I think, Steven Pinker's book, The Blank Slate, was, gave me some perspective. Some of the research he presented in that suggests that the degree to which parents can influence their children's personalities, or sort of long-term psychology is actually very limited, much more limited than we think. And we kind of naturally assume that a lot of things are nurture when, they're actually nature, or they're produced by aspects of the, non-shared environment, i.e. like stuff that siblings wouldn't be exposed to, living in the same household. So, a lot of how your kids turn out may be out of your hands, actually, which doesn't give you a license to abuse them, because you want to have a good relationship with them and have them be sort of, grow up with a positive worldview. My parenting philosophy is more kind of like give them what they need to thrive and stay out of their way, rather than try to shape them in some way through my constant ministrations.
Okay. Yeah, that whole nature versus nurture thing is pretty fascinating, because it's almost impossible to actually isolate them out.
Yeah, in individual cases, it's very difficult. Yeah. But, you can make estimations of heritability through things like twin studies and adoption studies. Mm-hmm. Someone just tweeted, Steve Stewart Williams, I think, just tweeted a link to a research study that was like tens of thousands of people in Scandinavia and life history tracking their rates of divorce. And it turns out that, your divorce proneness is something that will resemble your biological siblings and biological parents a lot more than your adopted siblings or adopted parents. So when you compare people that were adoptees versus people that grew up in the household of their biological parents, they're like, whether they have the kind of relationship history that has lots of divorces or just stayed with the same person or never got married or whatever, they're sort of like marital patterns seem to be largely heritable. You would think that babies adopted to a surrogate or a foster home from birth would maybe pick up some degree of their like attitude towards marriage off of their foster parents. Turns out not really.
Wow.
So yeah, those, the twin and adoption studies are pretty thought provoking, right? Because, if you've got identical twins that are separated at birth and grow up in completely different households, and they end up more similar to each other than they end up to the people that they were raised with from babies that are their adopted siblings, then how are you explaining people's personalities and behaviors based on what the parents did?
Yeah. Yeah. And when you're just looking at a single data point, it can be really easy to let a lot of confirmation bias in.
Yeah. And I think I sympathize with the desire to believe that you're shaping your kids. I feel like, when I'm reading I was late for this podcast because I was reading stories to my daughter, and, she loves it. And I like to think that I'm making her more literate, but I just don't, the skeptic in me goes, how would I know that? Maybe bookish people have bookish kids, whether they read books to them or not. Maybe bookishness, maybe that's something that, that she's genetically predisposed towards. And I'm just like feeding a hunger, not making her bookish. And either way, that's okay. We both enjoy it. And also, the view that you're not actually shaping your kids as much as you think you are by what you do with them has a positive flip side. It's not just nihilistic, because it also means you're not screwing them up as badly as you worry that you would be.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it all ties in with the whole, free will versus determinism debate too, which shouldn't even be a debate at all.
Why? Because everything's deterministic and we have no free will?
Yeah, yeah. The whole concept of free will doesn't make any sense without an immaterial soul. But the whole concept of it is, that belief in a free will mean you will behave better because you think you're in control of your actions. That's complete bullshit.
I think there may actually be some research that backs that up. Actually, I've read, I don't have the citation at hand, but I have read that there's some studies that show that if you tell people there's no free will, they behave more impulsively. They're like more likely to, you know, gamble rashly or, you know, eat high calorie foods instead of watching their weight or, you know, cheat on cooperation games and things like that. So I think telling people that they have free will actually does have an effect. Whether it has an effect deterministically or not is not resolved by that. But, you know, that those research studies suggest that believing in free will may be a morally desirable perspective, whether or not it can be defended via physics. But then you've got this argument for like maintaining ignorance when you wouldn't otherwise maintain ignorance. So that, you know, I think those are tricky. It's kind of like placebo, right?
Yeah.
Like we don't want to have a medical profession that's known to be based around deception. Therefore, even if placebos work, there's an ethical objection to using them in regular medical practice because people want to not feel like their doctors are lying to them.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, in my show, I talk about free will and it's one of the sort of upshots of looking at the brain, as the source of all of our consciousness and experience. And obviously the brain obeys the laws of physics. So how can we get free will? Well, I kind of do defend a compatibilist view of free will. Like free will is not something that happens at the level of atoms, but there can be a kind of free will that is legitimately called free will, which is a capacity that we've evolved and learned over the course of our lives to anticipate the consequences of our actions and take that into account when choosing our behaviors. And that, you know, that's not a magic kind of free will. It's like a capacity. Free will would be like learning to read. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm free to read a book and someone else is not free to read a book and I can choose whether to read it. I don't have access to the brain pattern activation states that led to the choice to read it, but the kind of freedom that you have when you've learned to do something is not a negligible kind of freedom, and learning to consider the consequences of your actions in terms of, you know, logistical, strategic, and also moral, ethical consequences. Like the definition of free will under the law, i.e. you weren't compelled, isn't a frivolous definition. I think it's an important one.
Right.
And, you know, if that's the only kind of free will we have, well, it's better than not having that kind of free will.
Well,
so
now I think there's a little bit of the issue with some of the studies is they tend to be looking at very short term experiments.
It's an immediate effect.
As opposed to like that first time you realize you don't have free will, it's really easy to go a little crazy, feeling like you're more free. And then you continue living life with consequences and that's going to impact your behavior. And I think with the law, it's even detrimental because the legal system is generally centered around the belief that people are independent moral agents. And if you are an independent moral agent, then if you did something wrong, you must be punished so you won't do it again. As opposed to finding out the reasons for that that behavior and trying to correct it.
Yeah, there's a defensible case for the law as it stands, even without a retribution context, right?
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, like deterrence is going to be a big factor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
And you don't need free will for deterrence to work. Although you do need the ability to recognize the disincentives of deterrence and act accordingly, which, you know, some would argue is a form of free will.
Yeah. Yeah. What projects do you have going on right now?
I'm creating a new show right now that I'm going to produce and premiere at the Brighton Fringe Festival in late May, which is called Darwinism. And it's about the evolutionary worldview from microbes to behaviors to society and culture and kind of just what it means to accept Darwin as right, at every possible level. So, you know, it's going to be another 1 hour, one man show that I'll be bringing to this festival and, we'll see where it goes from there, but I'm kind of just puzzling that out right now, looking for the right sources and, you know, just trying to tell the story of who we are and where where we're going and where we came from in a way that's entertaining and brings people into the fold of the science enthusiastic.
Very cool. And where can people find your stuff?
So online, there's a bunch of different records. I mean, Spotify, iTunes, Amazon Music, they're all out there. If you type in rap guide, I'm the only one making rap guides to various subjects. And also BabaBrinkman.com is my website, BABABRINKMAN.com. And, go check it out for yourself. Whatever you imagine scientific peer-reviewed rap sounding like, you may be making a Bayesian statistical error in your imagination. You got to hear it for yourself to find out.
Awesome. And okay, so we talked earlier about getting a song in on the show. You want to do that now?
Okay, well, since we talked about it, let's drop this good Bayesian track.
All right.
It's one of the records on Rap Guide to Consciousness. I just put the album out in the fall, and it features a couple of great guest rappers as well. There's a rapper called MC Lars who also does sort of like literary hip hop. He's got a whole record based on Edgar Allan Poe, and he dropped a verse on this about opening for Nas one time. And then also there's a rapper called Mega Ran who's got a whole like computer digital sort of a backpacker slash nerd rap style that's blowing people away right now. So the thing I love about this track is that I wrote just one verse and a chorus, and I'm like, okay, this one's going to be about Bayesian statistical analysis. Like, will people really connect with this? And I sent the track to Lars and Megaran, and they were like, oh, we got this. And they came back with these verses that are, I mean, go, you're going to hear it for yourself, but it was just cool to like throw something like this at rappers and have them be like, yeah, we can relate. Let's like get busy on this track.
Ah, very cool. And if you're listening on Spotify, you're going to need to find this yourself on Spotify, since I would get booted off of Spotify by actually playing it on the show on Spotify. But for everybody else, enjoy.
We don't just passively perceive the world, we actively generate it. So perception, figuring out what's there, has to be a process of informed guesswork in which the brain combines these sensory signals with its prior expectations or beliefs about the way the world is. The world we experience comes as much, if not more, from the inside out as from the outside in.
Let me show you how to be a good Bayesian and change your predictions after taking information in. And if you're thinking I'll be less than amazing, let's adjust those expectations.
What's a Bayesian? It's someone who cares about evidence and doesn't jump to assumptions based on intuitions and prejudice. A Bayesian makes predictions on the best available info and adjusts the probability, cause every belief is provisional. And when I kick a flow, mostly I'm watching eyes widen, maybe cause my likeness lowers expectations of tight rhyming. How would I know unless I'm rhyming in front of a bunch of blind men dropping placebo control? Old science like I'm Richard Feynman. Is it because of my looks or the fact that I talk like I'm mad for books? Either way, in the ecosystem of rap, I'm the platypus. So my patron saint on stage is Reverend Bayes. Just watch me update the predictions in everyone's brains, teaching a crowd about probabilistical statistical science. For instance, if the president's a proven degenerate liar, remember your priors and be skeptical whenever he's testifying. Is it always inaccurate? No, but you discount outliers, especially when he's testifying about non-citizens, Muslims, African-Americans, and other victims of dog-whistling, bigoted, unconscious bias, unreliable information. The antidote is to learn how to think like a Bayesian. So let me show you how to be a good Bayesian. Change your predictions after taking information in. And if you're thinking I'll be less than amazing, let's adjust those expectations. Let me show you how to be a good Bayesian. Change calculations after taking fresh data in. Those predictions that your brain is making, let's get them on a solid foundation.
It was 2009 and I was opening for Nas. Predicted they would love us, hypothesis was wrong. Crowd presented evidence, booing while I rhymed. They'd rather hear the message or New York state of mind. Was it my flow? No, I hardly lacked ability. Rapping with agility, check the probability. Not likely to give up under fierce choleric scrutiny. Refused to stop the show, though their peer review was news to me.
confusing me like the anti-science right. I was dripping like the ice caps. Yes, it was not my night, but I kept it Bayesian, cause the lane I'm in is solid. Anticipate results with my a priori knowledge. So never let a hater shower you with data that tells you you should quit. Drop the mic and be like, later. Two more songs, then like OJ, I was out. Saw Nas backstage and thanked him, grabbed my bag, and then I bounced.
Let me show you how to be a good Bayesian. Change your predictions after taking information. And if you're thinking I'll be less than amazing, let's adjust those expectations. Let me show you how to be a good Bayesian. Change calculations after taking fresh data in. Those predictions that your brain is making, let's get them on a solid foundation.
Felt like I was still a baby when I first learned to be a Bayesian. I would find myself within a constant state of frustration before the day begins. On Facebook, my sample consisted of people I called my friends, who self-aggrandized and post constantly aligned with the latest trends. Using inconclusive evidence to assess the probability that people would never examine what is true and accept the lie willingly. From my observation came a question: are people really so naive? Or is there a correlation between make-believe and what is on the screen? Cause it seems that we have forgotten this. The truth and politics are opposites. Humans are intelligent, and that's the layup of a hypothesis. So I would conduct an experiment by laying down a simple rap and wondering would every one of the people who heard this line call it fact? Even if it were verifiable, supportable, sustainable, considering the source, would anyone ask how that info is attainable? So I analyzed my data, the context in which I framed it in. 50% would agree with me, taking the info I gave to them. Maybe if I was the platinum pop star rocking football stadiums and not a little known rap artist whose status strictly subterranean, I can conclude they would place a higher value on the power of my cranium. But minds are forever changing them, and that, my friends, is Bayesian.
So let me show you how to be a good Bayesian. Change your predictions after taking information. And if you're thinking I'll be less than amazing, let's adjust those expectations. Let me show you how to be a good Bayesian. Change calculations after taking fresh data in. Those predictions that your brain is making, let's get them on a solid foundation.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Atheist Nomads. You can find show notes and contact information at atheistnomads.com. Follow us on Twitter at Atheist Nomads. And like us on Facebook at facebook.com/atheistnomads. Please subscribe to the show in iTunes, Stitcher, or your podcatcher of choice. And while you're there, feel free to leave us a review. Theme music is courtesy of Sturdy Fred. Until next time, this has been the Atheist Nomads.